issues they've hammered Biden and Democrats on, including high inflation and immigration. One House GOP member who opposed the $40 billion aid bill said, "A lot of Republicans said, 'I voted for that one, I'm not going to vote for any more,'" adding, "And then the backlash at home was fierce." The lawmaker, who was granted anonymity to speak frankly about the dynamics of the Republican conference, said, "America can't afford to provide a blank checkbook to Ukraine when we have inflation, rising gas prices, supply chain crisis, all of the above going on at home. That's what I'm hearing from my voters. Republicans are narrowly favored to win the House of Representatives, while control of the Senate is a toss-up. A Republican House in 2023 will likely be more conservative than previous majorities, which means more skepticism of providing money for Ukraine." The British newspaper The Guardian writes, Elizabeth Brough, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, said the difference in tone reflected internal foreign policy tensions. Elizabeth Brough said, "This is a good illustration of the two factions within the Republican Party. You've got the Trumpian side and then the more traditional Republican side. And on the Ukrainian issue, this has been played out in a very clear fashion." In another example of the internal friction, the Twitter account of the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC, put up a post at the end of September asking when Biden and the Democrats would end the gift-giving to Ukraine. The tweet was accompanied by a graphic that mentioned the official annexation by Russia of four Ukrainian regions. The tweet was taken down a few hours later and replaced with another describing the original as an unapproved statement and one that belittled the plight of the Ukrainian people. Former President Donald Trump has a long record of admiring Vladimir Putin and has suggested that the Ukrainians make a deal with him, highlighting the Kremlin's nuclear power. Far-right Trumpist Republicans like Marjorie Taylor Greene have echoed Moscow talking points, suggesting that the Ukrainian regime only exists because the Obama State Department helped to overthrow the previous government.
Midstream.
And so Saudi Arabia finally did it. With its great influence within the OPEC organization, the kingdom pushed, along with Russia, for approving a severe reduction in oil production by no less than 2 million barrels per day. This decision had a shocking impact on the United States, which, since the decision was issued last week, seems to be drowning in a state of hysteria. There are many considerations when explaining the Saudi drift, the most important of which are two reflections. The first is that Mohammed bin Salman wants the U.S. administration to understand that its refusal to recognize him as a full-featured legitimate ruler of Saudi Arabia will not remain without costs, and that he has no deterrent from shifting the electoral balance towards the Republican Party on the eve of midterm elections in the U.S. You can actually hear the Democrats hyperventilating on the verge of their inevitable defeat. The second reflection is that bin Salman has no choice but to stick to the soaring price of oil, hoping to yield more profit to implement his projects that come at a hefty price. In this, Mohammed bin Salman appears at the intersection of very clear interests with Russia, which in turn desperately needs effective weapons in the face of Western efforts to devalue Russia's energy exports and weaken its ability to finance its war against Ukraine. On the other hand, the Biden administration now faces difficult choices after it bet on a Saudi response, which quickly proved that these demands do not even rise to the level of wishful thinking. Now, although the U.S. has already begun considering steps to discipline the Saudi rebellion, nothing would probably protect it from the public anger that began to simmer as gas and goods prices took an upward trend in the U.S. market. It is now crystal clear that the Saudi-U.S. relationship as a whole has entered a new era, the most prominent of which is the loss of trust between the two sides, as the U.S. accuses Saudi Arabia of choosing Russia's side. Saudi oil minister Abdulaziz bin Salman, one of the crown prince's brothers who dominate many of the main centers in his regime, denounced these accusations, saying that the goal is to prevent the deterioration of prices in light of talk of a possible global recession. Considering that Saudi Arabia is insulted by U.S. accusations of siding with Russia, since according to the Saudi oil minister, OPEC Plus is not only composed of Russia and Saudi Arabia, but rather includes 13 member countries of OPEC and 10 countries outside it, and these unanimously agreed to adopt this choice. No doubt this Saudi position was not expected by Washington, especially after Biden's recent visit. The OPEC Plus announcement did come at a very sensitive time for the Biden administration and in light of attempts to isolate Russia, which is an important member of the Oil Exporters Alliance. It unexpectedly seems that the strategic alliance between Saudi Arabia and the United States of America has indeed come to an end. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A new chapter of tension came across the relations between Washington and Riyadh after Saudi Arabia adopted the decision of the recent OPEC Plus forum to reduce oil production by 2 million barrels per day, starting from the 1st of November, amid the loud attacks launched by the United States of America against Saudi Arabia, describing the decision to reduce oil production as a political support for Russia and a source of a new burden on global inflation. Now, Saudi Arabia denied these allegations, which it described as emotional statements to influence the U.S. midterm elections. This new rift came in the midst of an energy nightmare that the Western world is experiencing due to the developments of the war in Ukraine and unprecedented European sanctions on the oil sector in Russia. To discuss this issue with us from Washington is Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference, political writer and commentator. Thanks a million for being so early with us from Washington, Dr. Hafiz. Now, with the announcement of the decisions of the OPEC Plus summit, we see that U.S. President Joe Biden has a lot of difficult decisions to make, especially when he's trapped in a time game just weeks before the crucial midterm elections for Congress, diverting the attention of the public opinion in the United States towards this new energy crisis. The U.S. is annoyed as it considered this Saudi alignment with Moscow. Are you a bit surprised that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia said no to the United States of America on this very, very crucial matter?
Good morning, Marwa, or good afternoon to Grace. No, in fact, I'm not surprised at all. I think it was something that I have called about 4 or 5 years ago already. And I was seeing the evolution of the relationship between the Kingdom and the United States. Even though during the Trump administration, we could detect the signs of frustration within the government of Riyadh about the behavior of the United States. Those who were following very closely these attentions, you could see it, for instance, in certain editorials of Saudi newspapers, the frustration seeping. That would not have been possible had not a green light been given to these editorials. So, no, I'm not surprised. Secondly, I think it was very clear, especially in the last few years, that the balance of power has been shifting significantly outside the United States and outside the West. And I think the Saudi leadership, as well as many countries in the world, have realized that the United States and the West have no longer anything to offer. So it was almost a natural thing to see that. Now, what has accelerated this rift, as you've called it in your introduction, I think is that the United States, because it's running out of options, has tried to take over the OPEC, and by defining how much production needs to be done, made, and what is the price cap, that was against the laws of the market, as they always try to promote. And the decision that was taken by OPEC Plus is not a decision that was unilateral by the kingdom, but in the aftermath, and this is, I think, people fail to understand, in the aftermath of the summit that took place in Samarkand, which means that there is a new world order now in place, and not is going to take place. It's already in place. And the partners are discussing among themselves what are the decisions. So this is a decision which is a collective one made by the heads of states of the Samarkand attendees.
Well, we have heard several times that this world, a new world order, but this is the first time we actually feel it happening, and we see that the United States of America is in paranoia about this, which is why they are calling, especially the Democrats in the United States of America, they are calling, first of all, to withdraw missile defense systems from Saudi Arabia, and they are demanding to pass a NOPEC bill, which allows the American judiciary to consider punishing oil-producing countries like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia under the claims of monopolizing the strategic commodity of oil and raising its price. Are these empty threats just to scare the Saudis? Because it's not the Saudis that are being threatened here. Or is it just a stage that will pass?
No, I think it is a mixture of both. These are empty threats, and also it underlies a serious rift. But there is a basic contradiction between what the Democrats are proposing and the overall strategy followed by the United States. You cannot unilaterally withdraw a protection umbrella, and still keep your own bases in Saudi Arabia. So it is either a total withdrawal of U.S. forces, not only from Saudi Arabia, but also from the Arabian Peninsula, which would be consistent with what they're trying to do, or it is just an empty threat and a bluster. Second, I don't think that within the deep state in the United States, especially those who are running the foreign policies, like the neocon and the liberal interventionists, they will allow Congress or even the president to go through that kind of decision, because there are too many vested interests in maintaining these things. Lots of money to be made, and of course there is the basic admission of a total defeat and withdrawal from the region, which they are not able or they cannot accept at this stage. So I doubt very much that they will go through, even though that you may have lots of publicity around it.
Well, Dr. Hafez, Riyadh's agreement with Moscow within the OPEC Plus Forum, while ignoring U.S. Pressures to increase oil production, appear as another step on the path of strategic diversions between two historical partners. To further confirm the fact of this rift, the Wall Street Journal quoted U.S. officials as saying that Saudi Arabia hopes for acquiring more American-made guided missiles have almost vanished. Is this really a historic moment of political shift for the Arabian Peninsula, or is it merely a shift only as long as the Biden administration is there? I mean, if the Biden administration changes, will Saudi Arabia just reassess and then start over with its alliance, strategic alliance with the United States of America?
I've been asked this question several times, and I think it's a little bit of both. It could be at the time being that the lack of chemistry, so to speak, between the President Biden and the Crown Prince has fostered that kind of acceleration of the rift. It could be. And there are people who are betting that if the Republicans come back to power, and especially if President Trump gets back to the White House, that things will go better. I don't think so, because the rift, as I've already said it earlier, has started even within the presidency of Trump, when the United States was unable to defend the oil facilities in Saudi Arabia against the attacks of the Houthis, and also when it was unable to prevent, to assure the security of oil tankers in the Gulf, and of course unable to help or defend the United Arab Emirates. So you can see already the signs that the Americans were not in a position or not willing to do the defense. So the whole strategy was based on an exchange, security against oil. Now, if security cannot be provided by the United States, then the foundation of that kind of situation is no longer there. This is the basic premise. Now, between now and next, and the next 2 years, things may be created on the ground that will either consolidate this divergence between the United States and the kingdom, or it will, jeopardize this new tendency. I think that the diplomacy followed by the Russians and the Chinese and even by the Iranians is very well tuned and very well coordinated, and they are doing their utmost to draw into their orbit many Arab countries. Look what they have done with Turkey. They've managed to neutralize, to speak, Turkey, mm-hmm. and making clear to Turkey that its interest is in the East and no longer in the West. So this thing can also happen with the kingdom. And mm-hmm. I think this is a trend that we're going to observe.
Well, and it is going on at a fast pace. We are literally watching in a show the New World Order being formed. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ziad Al-Hafiz, former head of the Arab National Conference and political writer and commentator, for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter for West Asia specifically. Thank you. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be discussing how Iraq got out of its political stalemate.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Iraq completed the presidential elections and reopened the political process without considerable problems, despite the bombing, which is the message that targeted the Green Zone prior to the election session. This message was immediately denounced by the Sadrist movement in what seemed to be a proactive response to whomever would think to accuse the Sadrists for it. In the midst of this, the Sadrists, which chose to leave the political process in Iraq, finds itself alone with almost no options but to wait for the failure of the new government and pressure towards holding early elections, but without threatening the country's security, hopefully, which seems to be everyone's concern in Iraq and the region. Iraq ends political stalemate in the following report.
After three failed attempts, the Iraqi parliament finally succeeded in electing a president, who in turn appointed Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani as prime minister, in a move that is considered to lead the country out of a severe political crisis. Since the Iraqi legislative elections on October 10, 2021, the influential political parties in Baghdad, despite numerous negotiations, have not been able to agree on the name of a new president of the republic and the appointment of a new prime minister. At the heart of the crisis were the two major camps, the coordinating framework on the one hand and the Sadrist movement on the other hand. This led the Iraqi street to become tense, and matters even reached bloody confrontations, after which Muqtada Sadr announced his withdrawal from parliament, then his and his party's retirement from political work entirely. An option that worked in benefit for the coordination framework, making them the largest political bloc in parliament. And so the Iraqi parliament succeeded in electing Abdul Latif Rashid as president, a largely ceremonial position reserved for the Kurdish minority. In turn, the latter commissioned Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani to form a new government. Al-Sudani now, as required by the constitution, has 30 days to form a government. The biggest factor in the success of reaching this stage politically was the openness of Faleh al-Fayyad, head of the National Contract Coalition, and Ahmed al-Asadi, head of the National As-Sanad bloc, to the rest of their partners in the country, and their formation within the coordination framework and with the sovereignty Alliance and the Kurdistan Democratic Union Party, the State Administration Alliance, which agreed on the names of president and prime minister. Meanwhile, despite its retirement, the Sadr movement in Iraq announced its refusal to participate in any future government, condemning the assignment of Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani to form a government led by the coordinating framework. Muqtada Sadr's spokesperson, known as Assad's minister, Saleh Muhammad al-Iraqi, said in a statement, "In the midst of forming a coalition government of militia subordination that has not and will not meet the aspirations of the people, we deplore and denounce the suppression of the people's voice refusing to return Iraq to square one." The nomination of al-Sudanis by the coordination framework a few months back was a spark that ignited tension between the framework and the Sadrist movement, whose supporters staged a sit-in in front of parliament for about a month. Muqtada Sadr proved his ability to destabilize the political scene by mobilizing tens of thousands of his supporters to take to the streets. Hence, it is not wrong to say that al-Sudani's task will be a difficult one, and that the road ahead of him will not be paved and planted with roses, as there are multiple agendas brewing in Iraq, on top of which is the Sadr disapproval of anything related to the new prime minister.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, who is a journalist at the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Hamza. Now, the Iraqi political forces, through the election of Abdul Latif Rashid as president of the republic, ended a year-long political deadlock since the legislative elections that were held in October 2021. Where is the Sadrist movement from this new political phase in Iraq?
Thank you for having me on your show, Marwa. Leader of the Sadr movement, Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, took the decision himself to remove himself and his party from the Iraqi political scene. Of course, this decision came after a long string of events, consequences and developments, which in the end led to seemingly place Sadr in a losing position in the recent political events in Iraq. Naming PM Mohammad Shia al-Sudani specifically were basis for the political decision of retirement that was taken by Sayyid Sadr. If we go back to immediately after the legislative elections in Iraq in October 2021, up until our day, today, we see that a lot of events have developed on the Iraqi scene. Namely, what we witnessed from violence on the streets of Iraqi cities, which resulted in scores of deaths and injuries among Iraqi youth. At the end of the day, the main demand of Sadr out of these street escalations were unrealistic, as he demanded the resignation of several prominent figures from within the coordination framework. Obviously, these demands never saw the light of day, as it was nearly impossible to ask for the removal of political figures from Iraq's political scene simply because they have different views than that of Sadr when it comes to practicing politics. Add to that the continuous rhetoric and threats of resorting to violence, which basically isolated the Sadrist movement even further. This was evident by the Sadr supporters who took to the streets to wreak havoc, to raid public institutions, the country's parliament and presidential palace. All these steps that eventually led to resorting to armed clashes proved that won't open any way for the demands of Sadr to be met. Add to that the recent Russian-Ukrainian war, or rather, the US-Russian war on Ukraine soil, which urged the US to work towards finding peaceful political solutions in oil-exporting countries like Iraq, Yemen, and even in the US pressure against Zionist Israel to accept the Lebanese demands when it comes to the maritime border demarcation negotiations. All these regional developments led to Sadr finding himself left alone, with no local Iraqi political cover, nor a regional one. Not even from Saudi Arabia or the UAE, and neither from the US Embassy in Iraq, which was positive towards electing a new Iraqi president and prime minister. So was the opinion of the UN and other foreign embassies in Iraq. Hence, all these developments surpassed Sayyid Sadr's ambitions and demands. Rather, these demands became a burden towards finding peace and political security inside Iraq. This also led to ending the political stalemate in Iraq without having the Sadr movement on board.
But something happened during the parliament session while electing a president for Iraq. The Green Zone was hit by 9 Katyusha rockets, wounding 10 security forces. Who do you think would benefit from such violence at such a timing? I mean, what kind of a message are these perpetrators trying to send to Iraq?
يعني لطالما شكلت.
In the past year, the green zone in Iraq has been dealt with like a mailbox, where opposing parties in Iraq tend to communicate through using rockets and gunfire instead of actual dialogue. Last week, one of the scenarios would suggest that launching 9 rockets during the parliament session to elect a president in Iraq was perceived by many Iraq observers as a message that reflects that there are people who do not benefit from electing a new president and naming a new PM in Iraq. The message was simple. Whomever launched these rockets decided not to remain on the sidelines as the political stalemate in Iraq was nearing an end. What was noticeable was that the Sadr movement was the first party to denounce the attack, which insinuates that the leadership of the Sadrist movement is truthful when it comes to preserving the security in the country. However, as it is well known inside Iraq that the Sadrist movement has several arms that are spread out of the span of control of the set of Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr. There exist several sub-parties within the Sadrist movement itself that might have planned and executed on its own, away from the approval of the Sadr movement leadership. There is also another scenario that implies that one of the many foreign intelligence apparatuses operating inside Iraq would benefit from inciting chaos, might be actually behind these attacks. However, that electoral day ended with electing a new president and naming a new prime minister.
Yes, as you said, the coordination framework made sure that Mohammad Shaya al-Sudani would be named as prime minister, but al-Sadr was not happy because we all heard the statement coming from his minister stating that Sadr considers the framework as liars and deceivers and that Sayyid Muqtada can never agree with them. Is that an indication for a possible new political deadlock in Iraq?
The position of Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr is open and crystal clear. He has not changed his position yet when it comes to naming Mohammad Shia al-Sudani as prime minister. Especially that the choice of al-Sudani by the coordination framework was the main reason for the Sadr movement protests and sit-ins 2 months ago, which resulted in the death of 50 people. The choice of al-Sudani again announced a defeat to al-Sadr and his political stances. However, the developments following the electoral process, which are fully supported by Iraqi parties who want to see a political solution in Iraq, it was evident that Muqtada al-Sadr will play the role of the opposition towards al-Sudani's government to be, whether in the streets or on parliament. Mind you, Sadr had already withdrew all his representatives from parliament and he still refuses to be part of any political solution or to have ministers named on his movement's behalf or at least names allies to his movement. All these suggestions so far are being turned down by Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, yet refusing or accepting any of the proposed political solutions to get Sadr back on board the Iraqi political scene will reflect the discourse which Sadr will choose to take when it comes to the soon-to-be-appointed Iraqi government. Sadr bets that he can mobilize the streets again as a weapon to bring down any appointed government and push for early parliamentary elections.
That's what is risky, to see actually people going back to the streets, which might get things out of control, but we hope that it doesn't. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar, for joining us to discuss this issue. And I want to thank you, ladies and gents, for being with us and following through what we are bringing to you every week. We'll see you again next week with new topics.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the years following the 11th of September 2001, anti-Muslim sentiments has grown in the United States. Studies showed from 2001 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims in the United States increased by 500%. According to experts, former U.S. President Donald Trump's approach against Muslims is an example of an unprecedented anti-Islamic government in America. But what is currently worrying is that manifestation of Islamophobia has not decreased in the administration of current President Joe Biden. We will now take a look at the world media's coverage of this subject. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera's website writes, "The Muslim population of the United States has increasingly been the target of Islamophobia and hate crimes in the years following the suspicious 9/11 attacks, which unleashed a new era of racism and discrimination against Muslims. On the 21st anniversary of the attacks on Sunday, 11th of September, the executive director of the Los Angeles chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, Hossam Ailush, said that Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence. Hossam Ailush added, "Muslims continue to be the target of hate, bullying and discrimination as a result of the stereotypes that were perpetuated by Islamophobes and the media in the years following the 9/11 attacks." According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Muslims skyrocketed immediately after the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and are still on an upward trend. Hossam Ailush said, "The unfortunate reality is there are people and organizations that benefit from perpetuating Islamophobia, bigotry and war." Ailush further said that the statistics were not surprising considering the current volatile political climate in the United States, perpetuated by former President Donald Trump during his term in office, adding, "Trump's presidency normalized being an anti-Muslim bigot. He made it socially acceptable to be overtly anti-Muslim." Upon taking office in January of 2017, Donald Trump signed an executive order that banned travel to the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Citing the Muslim ban, Ailush said, "Although the current administration overturned that ban, we're still dealing with the ramifications of it to this day, with many families still being separated." Hossam Ailush noted that the U.S. has a long history of dehumanizing and marginalizing ethnic and religious groups, including Native Americans, African Americans, and Asian Americans. The Hill, an American newspaper based in Washington, D.C., explains more about this story. Since the 11th of September 2001 attacks, Muslims living in the United States have experienced political and cultural firsts, along with an exponential rise in hate crimes, bullying, harassment, and racial profiling. In the years following the 9/11 attacks, anti-Muslim sentiments grew in the United States. Data from Brown University revealed from 2000 to 2009, hate crimes against Muslims spiked 500%. Beyond former President Barack Obama's presidency, critics contend that former President Donald Trump's policies exhibited animosity towards the community, such as his Muslim travel ban, which included predominantly Muslim countries. In 2020, the Justice Department found there were 110 anti-Muslim incidents in the United States. The Department of Justice also found that religion was the second most common reason for single bias incidents in the United States. A Pew Research survey found U.S. Republicans increasingly associated Muslims with Islam and violence, with 72% of Republicans in 2021 believing Islam was more likely than other religions to encourage violence. Among Democrats, 32% felt the same. Abdullah Hamoud, the first Muslim American mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, told Changing America that there was a sense of urgency among members of the Muslim American community to step up and push back against Islamophobia in a post-9/11 America. Before becoming mayor of Dearborn, Hamoud ran for a seat in Michigan's state legislature. He shared that doors were slammed in his face when he introduced himself. Representatives Rashiba Tlaib, a Democrat from Michigan, and Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota, became the first Muslim women to be elected to Congress. The Progressive Squad members are two of the most prominent Muslim voices in American politics, elected in the Blue Wave 2018 midterm elections during the Trump administration. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have previously shared that they've received violent threats during their time in U.S. Congress. The Middle East Monitor has more on the same story. Commemorations for the 9/11-2001 events remain an important part of U.S. history, but for Muslim Americans, post-9/11 ramifications of Islamophobia have bled deep into the fabric of American society more than two decades later. As a result, 21 years after the suspicious attacks, Muslims continue to face the threat of targeted violence and are working to amplify narratives about Muslims that are authentic and accurate to counter the spread of misinformation. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes immediately against Muslims skyrocketed after the 9/11 attacks, rising 1.61% from 2000 to 2001, marking some of the highest hate numbers of Islamophobic hate crimes ever seen in America. Referring to an August 2022 study, Zahra Jamal, Associate Director of Rice University's Bonnyuk Institute for Religious Tolerance in Houston, Texas, said 62% of Muslims report feeling religion-based hostility from others, and 65% have felt disrespected. That's almost three times the percentage among Christians. She said Muslims in the United States also reported that they have been threatened with physical violence, chased or followed, or had their home vandalized due to their religion. They also have higher rates of experiencing physical assault or property damage due to their religion. According to Zahra Jamal, just over 80% of Muslims reported that others assumed things about them due to their religion, while 21% of Muslim adults reported police harassment. She said the numbers related to discrimination against Muslims are alarming and show just how much Islamophobia has increased in the United States over the past several years. Zahra Jamal added, "For Muslims, scores on the Islamophobia Index have increased from 18 in 2018 to 26 in 2022. 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
In the last four decades, Iranian women have leapfrogged in the development of civil society, arts, sciences, championship sports, and have created inclusive excellence. Indeed, Iran is indebted to its zealous women who have made progress possible for the post-revolutionary Islamic Republic. Their sacrifices within the family and society as a whole have proven their indispensable worthiness in a variety of capacities time and again. We can be certain that if it weren't for their consistent participation and support, Iran would not be able to successfully withstand 8 years of an imposed war by Saddam Hussein's army, or over 40 years of thousands of illegal sanctions by Western powers, and all the other challenges from within an ever-evolving post-revolutionary society. Woman means honor, humanity, motherhood, and peace in Iranian culture. Furthermore, women are the beacon of morality, virtue, and insight in Islamic teachings. In recent weeks, enemy forces have gone into a frenzy to plant division and violence within Iranian female communities. They have been hiding behind the peaceful social issues of Iranian folks, while the actual aim is to overthrow the Islamic Republic. Women's issues appear to be an opportunistic veil that covers their intent to undermine Iran's progress and resistance. To gain a better understanding of Iranian women, their accomplishments, and their status as an unshakable foundation of Iranian society in the face of adversity, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. A few years ago, the New York Times published a report that the revolution of 1979 was a positive turning point for Iranian women in all fields.
My overall view on this issue of success is that how do we perceive success, and then we can look at it gender-wise. From my point of view, success is when you have a goal with a plan. Whether a man or a woman, in order to achieve success, first of all, one should have self-belief. From my point of view, the main success is that you love what you do so much that you might even be willing to spend money to achieve that goal rather than just thinking about income. Maybe this is an ideal in my mind. Maybe the majority of society is now in a situation where they have problems for their livelihood. But the thing is, a successful person, whether a man or a woman, with all the problems that may exist, must first have that self-confidence to draw her goals. And in my opinion, that is rooted in the culture of his family first. Also, the things one has learned may be at the level of school education, which is separate from the family. Let's say that an amalgamation of all the factors that make a successful person, male or female, should be considered. After all, we cannot deny the things related to male and female biology. Of course, there are differences, and everyone should know the difference, know their abilities, and be able to reach that goal they set in their mind with a proper planning. And the main thing is that one should not be afraid of what she feels in her heart and should be able to actually move towards it.
According to a WHO report, within the first 20 years of the establishment of the Islamic Republic, the number of male doctors increased 3 times, but the number of female doctors increased 12 times, increasing the ratio of female doctors from 15% to 40%, while increasing the ratio of female specialist physicians from 9% to 30%, and increasing the ratio of female doctors in the field of obstetrics and gynecology from 16% to 98%. Today, there are several female-only hospitals operational in Iran, mostly attached to universities and medical schools.
Some time ago, a news came out that a scientific research team, which was composed of a group of women, sent a very good article to one of the most prestigious foreign scientific journalists, and the editor's response was very interesting. He wrote, "Why there is no man in your research group?" It was very interesting to me that how is it possible as a scientist myself, if I want to consider the research groups I work with, how is it possible for them to say this and interpret that you have an ideological discussion with this combination? You didn't put a man in your research group. To engage with this type of thinking, it has its own complexities. To say that one part of the world has this type of view and the other does not, no. I think we are all people who grow up with these ideals of our ancestors. And after all, a woman has special responsibilities that in some cultures it more bold, and this is mostly due to family culture.
A recent analysis of Global Data's clinical trials database shows that over the course of the last 10 years or so, Iran has consistently been a leader in terms of the number of phase 3 clinical trials carried out in women's health. According to the analysis, which was published a few days ago, Iran's dominance in women's health is spread fairly comprehensively across many indications, with more trials than any other country in most indications. Women's life expectancy has increased from 51 years in 1978, before the 1979 Islamic Revolution, to 75 years now, said Ensia Ghazali, Vice President for Women's and Family Affairs, on the occasion of National Women's Health Week. The event is usually held in the last week of the Iranian calendar month of Mehr, ending on October the 22nd. The motto is to promote physical activity for the well-being of Iranian women.
Women are more willing to work out these days. There is a sort of competition between them. There are several reasons why they want to exercise. As the head of a sports complex, I've seen ladies coming here to lose weight so they could feel confident in their personal lives or at their workplace or anywhere else. It boosts their self-confidence. That's why they're a lot more willing to work out. It helps them with their self-confidence and mental health. This contributes to better public health. Women like to be champions and live in an environment where they can grow. When they see other women achieving their goals, they are motivated to attain their own goals too and regret what they haven't achieved. It'll serve society if we take the necessary steps to encourage women to become champions.
Today, in addition to diverse recreational sports activities available to most people in the country, women's competitions are held in countrywide leagues in soccer, basketball, volleyball, squash, kabaddi, and close to 200 other sports, including all varieties of martial arts and race car driving.
You see, in the debates that the Imam had in the field of women at the beginning of the revolution, many clerics may have not agreed with him. But this approach was changed by Imam's view. In fact, he changed this paradigm that women are important. The role of women in the civil society is important, and that the presence of women in the community does not have the objectification effect, and she can play her role effectively.
To better understand the Islamic Republic's continued commitment to promote and create equal opportunities for women, let's talk about a few out of many proud Iranian ladies who are representing the country at the highest levels of sports competition internationally. A couple of years ago, Iranian doctors Zohra Haratian and Bahar Hassan Mirzai joined the Asian Football Confederation AFC history books by becoming the first women medical officers to be appointed in an AFC men's club competition. They were among 9 medical officers, including doping control officers, working behind the scenes to ensure the safety of players and officials at the AFC Champions League East in Doha, Qatar.
In many of the issues raised by Imam Khomeini, the roles of women and men are seen side by side. He says that all these disturbances that exist, men and women should work together to solve them. And therefore, I want to tell you that the approach of the revolution to the women's issue was that women should come and take part and play a role in the destiny of the country. The record of the Islamic Republic itself is very clear in this matter. The achievements of the Islamic Revolution in the field of women's education, the role that women play in the international arena, such as sports and other arenas, such as politics and foreign affairs, show that the Islamic Republic, according to Imam's approach, was concerned about including women. The Islamic Republic does not consider only the role of family and housework for women. It considers women as a social element that, according to its social responsibility, should play her role.
Meanwhile, the Mansurian sisters, well known to the world for their wushu capabilities, have brought several gold and other colorful medals from the world competitions to the country in recent years. Additionally, the glory of colorful medals gained by other female athletes of Iran from different Olympic, World, and Asian Games show that women's position has strengthened over the past several years. It was a record for Iran's sports history when 9 Iranian women were qualified for the Rio 2016 Olympic Games for the first time. Participation of Iran's female weightlifters in the world competitions had international reactions, as the International Weightlifting Federation congratulated Iran for sending 4 female weightlifters to this year's World Championships. Another unforgettable victory was gained in 2018 when Iranian women won the gold medal in Kabaddi at the Asian Games in Jakarta. In 2015, Iranian woman Najmeh Khidmati won the first ever shooting gold medal of women's 10-meter air rifle at the 2015 University Games, World University Games in South Korea. Also in 2014, Iranian athlete Leila Rajabi was awarded a silver medal at the women's shot put final in South Korea. All these medals and achievements have been gained by the Iranian women who participated in international events wearing Islamic hijab.
When an athlete wants to compete and aims at winning the prize, the hijab won't be an issue for her. She won't even think of whether the hijab would be a hurdle. I personally haven't thought like this. Maybe in other sports, including those in which the organizing country might prevent you from participating because of your hijab, like in swimming or similar sports, the situation might be different, but we've been raised wearing hijab. The other point to mention is that there is an endless variety for wearing hijab at this point. We have so many different options to wear. We can choose perfectly comfortable sportswear.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Commenting on the significance of the hijab and sports in the past, Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, has made the remarks that everybody should appreciate from the bottom of their heart the value of female athletes who participate in international arenas while observing hijab and modesty.
I'm serving you as a representative of people. Expressing demands is a public right. Every Iranian citizen has the right to express his or her demands, and the Constitution provides this opportunity. The form of our parliament and our city councils is in such a way that because they receive votes directly from the people, they have direct interaction and communication with the people, and that they actually listen to the demands of the people. people. This is the basic approach that I usually see my colleagues have. They are serious about this matter, and I know that this approach exists in city councils and similar institutions. I think that listening and talking and communicating and seeing women's demands definitely helps to improve the status of women's society.
Today, the ladies determine the way for the girls to reach the peaks of tomorrow. Iranian women who diligently moved women's sports forward have proven that they are a vital segment of society and that God has given dignity to all human beings. In light of these efforts, today a rising generation of Iranian female athletes are displaying their power and pride on international stages as they are surpassing their predecessors. Leading the way, Iranian weightlifter Elham Hosseini claimed 3 gold medals in the women's 81 kilograms weight class of the 2022 Asian Weightlifting Championships in Manama. She made history by becoming the first Iranian female weightlifter to win gold at an international tournament. After the medal ceremony, she told the press that I would like to thank you all who helped me in these years. I want to win a medal in the World Weightlifting Events and 2024 Olympic Games.
I think that the officials of the country, in the light of their experiences, realize that some jobs need to have some elegance in them, even if they are production units. But in creating harmony among all elements, the discussion of mere production becomes boring. Our colleagues may be producing vaccines around the clock. If there is not really that compassion and caring, which can come from the gentle soul of a woman, I don't want to talk about this organization in particular. There are other places that you can talk about. Well, this is understood in the country, and in many places we witness that women have been able to be very successful in some occupations that have been considered male-oriented until now, and that they have been allowed to show their abilities and be recognized as successful individuals and be appreciated, especially in the scientific fields, where they have received special awards. This is a sign that this fertile field has been provided to them so that they can grow.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into the world of media to see what other outlets have to say. Here's how it looks on the page. Irna reads, Iran women rifle team win bronze in ISFF Cairo 2022 World Championship. On the fourth day of the world competitions in Egypt, while the Iranian men's team reached the final and won the silver medal, the Iranian women beat Mongolia to win the bronze medal. The Iranian women in the 10-meter rifle match comprised Hania Rostamian, Golnoush, Sebghatullahi and Mina Qorbani, who beat Mongolia 14-16 to win the World Championships bronze. Al-Bawaba reads, banning the hijab in Europe, a first step. The court justifies its decision by invoking neutrality clause, which rights activists have previously slammed for opening the door to widespread employment discrimination. A top European Union EU court has ruled in favor of barring women with headscarves from entering workplaces, saying that the ban does not constitute discrimination if it is part of a wider restriction applied to all workers. The decision has been criticized by rights activists, with some calling it a violation of free choice, expression, belief, and their women's bodily autonomy. The Court of Justice of the European Union, CJEU, refers to the case of a woman who took her company to court for dismissing her application for an internship after she had refused to take her headscarf off to comply with company policy. In its latest ruling, the CJEU states that religion and belief must be treated as a single ground for discrimination in order to avoid undermining the general principle enshrined in EU law for equal treatment in employment and occupation. But such legal decisions have already impacted thousands of Muslim women across Europe. For instance, in Germany, many Muslim women resigned from their teaching and civil service jobs as the court gave them the stark choice of removing their headscarves or giving up their careers. In France, women wearing a niqab or burqa, which fully cover the body and face, in public space, faced a €150 fine. Al Jazeera runs the headline, Iran accuses Great Satan US of inciting chaos, terror. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi accused United States President Joe Biden of inciting chaos after he expressed support for demonstrations against the death of Mahsa Amini, a woman who died in Iranian government custody nearly a month ago. The remarks of the American president, who is inciting chaos, terror, and the destruction of another country, serve as a reminder of the eternal words of the founder of the Islamic Republic, who called America Great Satan, Raisi said, referring to the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Raisi accused the United States of starting unrest in the past.